This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It is April 1953, London. Preparations for the coronation of the new king, King Edward VIII. The preparations include a very, very famous movie director, Leni Riefenstahl. She is in the cathedral directing the archbishop in a run-through, in a prep for the crowning of King Edward VIII and Queen Wallis Simpson. Wallis Simpson is bored, and at some point, Leni Riefenstahl asking the archbishop, can't we get rid of this chair? It is the chair of Edward the Confessor. Wallis Simpson comes forward and engages Leni Riefenstahl. Clearly, the two very powerful women do not like each other. This is a scene from a new novel, a dystopian romance, Widowland by C.J. Carey. The subtitle, To Control the Past, They Edited History. To Control the Future, They Edited Literature. I welcome Jane Thin, the novelist, who is also C.J. Carey. The book is a revelation of what might have been, but also reflects where we are now in the 21st century, thinking back those 70, 80 years to the dark moments when Britain was challenged by the advancing German Empire. Jane, congratulations and wonderful. And I go to this scene later in your book. This is a work of fiction. We're not going to give away the ending. It's extremely tense. But this scene illustrates everything that I made me laugh when I also grimaced reading your story. What do you want us to understand in this scene about Leni Riefenstahl, Wallis Simpson, and what might have been? Good evening, Jay.
Hello, and I'm so pleased to be with you, John. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. It's an alternative history. The book itself, the novel itself, is about actually how easily history can be rewritten. And the whole setup is, as you say, set around the coronation of Wallis and Edward. And I want you to emphasize how easily, what a tiny little step it would have been for our history, Britain, and also America, ultimately, to have gone in a different direction if a few things had been different back in 1940. If, for example, the king at the time had his way and had Lord Halifax instead of Churchill as prime minister, and if Halifax had then sued for peace with Hitler, and had agreed to reinstate Edward VIII. One of the things, I've written many, many novels about pre-war and wartime Europe, and one of the things that's always been one of the central issues of interest for me is the meeting between Edward VIII and Hitler in 1937. It was at the Berghof. It was during Edward VIII's honeymoon, and they were alone together in a room, apart from an interpreter. And we've never known exactly what they've discussed, but historians have extrapolated from hints given later that they may well have discussed Edward's willingness to return to Britain in the case of an alliance and to become basically a puppet king. And so this is the reality that's come about in Widowland.
Yes, and the movie star, the movie director, Leni Riefenstahl, is there to memorialize this event, Edward's crowning, because present is the leader. The leader has come from Berlin to attend this ceremony. Of course, Leni Riefenstahl is planning to make the leader the center of her movie, panning very few faces that aren't perfectly chiseled. However, we go to this being a novel, a work of fiction. We have a heroine. Our heroine, Rose Ransom, observes this unusual conversation between Wallis Simpson and Leni Riefenstahl, and Jane makes it very clear that Wallis Simpson has a Baltimore twang. It's quite charming at that point, and smoking heavily. We go to Rose Ransom, who observes it. Rose Ransom is a young woman known as a jelly. She works, her job is to rewrite English literature. And her challenge to rewrite Wuthering Heights impressed me so much, I think she's talented. But in the alternative universe that Jane presents to us, Wuthering Heights had to be changed. Jane, Rose Ransom is a jelly. What does that mean? And what are the other categories that the protector, Mr. Rosenberg, has forced upon the English society?
So one of the terrible things about this alternative society is that a caste system has been introduced for women. Women are divided into one of six classes, and the Gellies, named after Angela Raubel, who was actually Hitler's niece and very beloved of him, are the elite caste of women, and Rose, our heroine, is one of those. And the horror of this, and then we go through the classifications of women, and we have Magdas, and we have Lennies. Lennies are named, actually nicknamed after Leni Riefenstahl, and they're people who work in offices and in kind of more white collar environments. And we have Magdas who work in shops, and Gretels who do the drudge work. And right at the bottom, we have a category that are nicknamed Friedas, which is short for Friedhofsfrauen, which means cemetery women. And they are widows and spinsters over the age of 50 who have no children and no man. And they are the lowest of the low. And they are confined to rundown areas, which are nicknamed widowlands. Everybody calls them widowlands. Actually, this came about, this idea came about because I was researching the treatment of women in World War II in Germany. And during the end of the war, when they were having to revise the rationing downwards for the remaining civilians, they had a category who were nicknamed cemetery women, who were these women over 50, who were considered sort of useless. And so they got the lowest amount of calories, and they got the lowest of everything. And I thought, actually, widowlands, this idea where you have these women who peripherally are considered, you know, marginalized and useless, but are actually, as we all know, of women over the age of 50, great readers, incredibly literate, and they have become, in this society, the last bastion of literacy in a society that is determined to effectively stamp it out. So I wanted this subversive group of women who are reviled and despised to become the heroines of the novel.
And they do indeed, because they lead the resistance, such as it is, because they insist upon literature not being distorted, perverted by rewrites. But Rose Ransom, our young woman, and I'm glad you said, you corrected, I did not ask. I said Jelly, you say Gelly, you were pronouncing it the German fashion, Angela, whereas I was pronouncing it the English fashion, Angel, named for her mother.
Yeah.
So Gelly, Gelly has advantages, better clothes, better food. They are young, very attractive. There aren't any men. There aren't any men in all of Great Britain. There are very few, once or two, and you have one young man, Oliver, who everybody disdains because he's so passive. But where are the men? You don't answer that. And Rose doesn't really know, because like everything else in your book, it just isn't a problem for her. That is quite striking, Jane, and realistic too, because when the authorities declare something doesn't exist, it's very difficult to talk about it, and the men don't exist.
Exactly. So one of the interesting things about writing this book was, and I actually wrote it before the pandemic, was I wanted to conjure a society in which there's a huge amount of ignorance, and to show how easy it is to prevent people understanding and having a wider world view. So in this society, no foreign travel's allowed, and the foreign news coming in is very heavily filtered. And I couldn't have believed, actually, that a year later we would be living in an England where no foreign travel's allowed. But it's that sense of not knowing what's going on. So in the novel, all the men between of working age, between 17 and 45, have been sent on extended national service, and they've been sent to the mainland, which is what occupies occupied Europe is called, to just as labourers. And but the women don't know where they've gone. So it's a city of women. It's a nation of women, and they have to make do with the much older men who are too old to be sent on national service, and the German men, the occupiers, the conquerors. So Rose herself is the mistress of the assistant cultural minister, and she, like many other of her peer group, are with men whose wives are back in Germany.
So we're looking at a culture that is adapting to extreme conditions, as we all know we have this last year. But there are historical figures here, and they're introduced for the edification of what might have been, not just the leader, not just Edward VIII, but when we come back, Alfred Rosenberg, the villain.
Yeah.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm speaking to C.J. Carey, the nom de plume of the author Jane Thin, who writes literature as well under Jane Thin, but right now writing Widowland. To control the past, they edited history. To control the future, they edited literature. Who is obsessed with books? Rosenberg. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Very much pleased to be able to speak to C.J. Carey, the author of Widowland, a new dystopian romance. Jane Thin is the author who's very familiar with C.J. Carey. This is her name for writing a book about a future that didn't happen. However, you can entertain again and again moments when history turns this way or that way. In this book, literature is at the center of the story, not just history, but literature. If you'll consider the novels we read and enjoy over the last several hundred years, the English novel, tell us how people lived. That is history. History is written at the moment and then rewritten at the next moment. Rose Ransom's job is to rewrite literature. Wuthering Heights made me smile all the way. How do you change Heathcliff? How can you do this? But the man Rosenberg is the protector of Great Britain, the protector of England. Jane, he's obsessed with books. Why? What do we know about Rosenberg? And I believe Hitler and his lot were obsessed with books too. Do we understand why?
Certainly. So the motor of this book came from something that I stumbled across. And when I was researching Nazi Germany, and Alfred Rosenberg was a real person, and he was a sort of philosophy guru for Hitler. And during World War II, he established an SS task force that went through the libraries of occupied Europe looking for history books. Now, we have this image of the Nazis burning books. Everybody's seen those pictures of the bonfires and people tossing books onto them. But what he was doing was much more subtle and also extraordinary, which is that he employed this task force of scholars to rewrite history books to give the correct National Socialist spin so that the history books themselves would reflect a different history. And I sort of then took an imaginative leap, and I thought, so if he came to England, what he might do was set people to rewrite English literature. And one of the great problems that the Nazis had with women was this idea that women could potentially challenge male authority or be subordinate or subversive or set themselves up as independent. And of course, if you look at the history of 19th century English literature, the Brontes and George Eliot and Jane Austen, they're all about young women or women who gain agency and self-knowledge and become independent. And so I thought, how extraordinary if you had a young woman with not very much self-awareness or knowledge who had to actually rewrite these great classics and in the process obviously gain self-knowledge herself and realizes and the scales fall from her eyes. So that was the challenge I set myself, to have Rose how Rose would think about rewriting, say, Emma, you know, Jane Austen's Emma, or Pride and Prejudice, how you would make these heroines a bit less intelligent and less subversive.
Because it's not acceptable for a common person to marry Rochester. He's above the station. There's the challenge for Jane Eyre. How can we get to the payoff? I mean, that's a brain twister, Jane. I mean, really.
It is a brain twister. I mean, so in the Mr. Rochester and Jane Eyre scenario, one of the things that I include is that, as we know in that famous story, Bertha Mason, Mr. Rochester's first wife, is confined in the attic as a mad woman. And in my story, when Rose discovers this, she's in a quandary because this seems actually perfectly acceptable. That surely that's a rather caring thing to do, to look after your wife and put her in the attic if she's gone mad. And surely that's completely in alignment with Nazi ideals. And it seems completely unfeminine of Jane Eyre to just reject Mr. Rochester on that account. So it's the pleasure of it was seeing it through different eyes. It's all about perspective and how somebody who is brought up in a different tradition and will see those great stories of independence through different eyes. And of course, the other main part of the novel is that there's an outbreak because the leader is coming to England for the first time in 13 years since the alliance was formed. He's coming to visit England. And all this graffiti is appearing everywhere, and it's very embarrassing, and it's subversive. It's a Samizdat verses and lines from English literature, Virginia Woolf and Charlotte Bronte, etc., and Mary Wollstonecraft. And the authorities are extremely worried about this and want it stamped out before he arrives.
And that's the assignment given to Rose, to find out who's doing this. And of course, we're not telling you because it's a thriller. However, yes. Again and again, Jane, as I read your book, you know I swim through the news. That's what I do. I was reminded that the worst and the most complete and the most self-destroying kind of censorship is self-censorship. I observed this today in the 21st century during the pandemic. I know you in England see it too. We're all suffering with it.
It's a great. I think it's a preoccupation that must definitely afflict most thinking people nowadays. This issue of censorship and self-censorship. It's consuming our culture, and I grew up at a time when these Enlightenment values of free speech and the famous dictum of Voltaire, I may hate what you say, but I defend to the death your right to say it. Everybody knew these. Everybody repeated them. It seemed inviolable in a democracy that you would have free speech. And so I think that it's taken my generation by surprise, the speed with which not just cancel culture, but also censorship is engulfing and complicating our cultural life. And it's a very deep issue. But your point about actually self-censorship is now more of a concern than censorship itself. Absolutely true. I was channeling for a lot of this. I mean, whenever you write a dystopia, it's not hard to look around and channel existing societies or recent societies. And I was channeling East Germany, for example, in which any totalitarian society, you watch what you say, you police yourself. And that is the idea. And I was very interested. I was very taken during the pandemic by something that the government behavioral unit here said, which was that people were complaining that the regulations were not clear. And you weren't quite sure what you were and weren't allowed to do, how many people could meet at any one time. And they said, we want that. That's what we want, for it not to be clear. Because if you're not absolutely certain what the rule is, you will err on the side of caution. And so I think it's almost a tool of social control to keep people censoring themselves. And so I'm tremendously interested in that. It's a deep and complicated issue, but it's such an important issue now.
The book is Widowland, It is a novel, a work of fiction, which is why we're not telling you the end. We're not even telling you close to the end. We just gave you a scene close to the end with Leni Riefenstahl and Wallace Simpson. Widowland, written by C.J. Carey, a pseudonym, a nom de plume, of Jane Finn, the English novelist. To control the past, they edited history. To control the future, they edited literature. Editing Jane Eyre, my goodness. Editing Wuthering Heights, what a challenge. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.